Stand to Reasons, hashtag STRask podcast. I'm Amy Hall, and with me is Greg Kokel. Hello, Greg.
Hi there, Amy.
Today, we're going to start with a question from Richard. Can science test supernatural world... Can science test supernatural worldviews? If so, how so? If not, why not?
Science is equipped with its methodology, and that's all I'm going to talk about here. I'm not going to talk about the reigning philosophical paradigm that largely controls what science is allowed to say, all right, which would be materialism. We're not doing that. We're setting aside and trying to deal with science as an epistemic motif, as a way of gaining knowledge, and it's meant to be used to tell us true things about the physical world because it uses principally empirical methods, observations, experiences, that sensory mechanisms that we possess to see things in the physical world and then test in such a way that we can infer causation relationships, particularly event causation. So if one event causes another event, they can tell you, they're in principle able to tell you about that. You take a base and you add it to an acidic liquid and you get salt and water. I mean, that's just the way those things work. We know the chemical reactions that lead to the consequence, all right? So it is certainly capable of telling us things about the physical world. Now, I think that even though it is not capable of measuring the non-physical world, we can properly infer things about the non-physical world based on some things we see in the physical world. Okay, so what careful science can do is identify intricate design features in the world that, which design features say are irreducibly complex. That is, the whole thing has to be assembled just so before it can function the way it's meant to function, and no part of it can function at all. Now, this implies that the thing had been assembled in some fashion before it can function. No naturalistic process can account for this, certainly not an evolutionary process, not classic Darwinian evolution, which requires that every little change along the way has to have some reproductive benefit. It has to. So what science can do is it can determine that these structures exist, and the structures could not have been assembled bit by bit and still have any function at all, but rather had to be assembled as a whole. Now, we can intuit from that observation a designer, because we know from personal experience, being agents ourselves, that we can assemble things and make things that don't work as parts, but then do work as a whole. I'm looking at a telephone in front of me. I'm using a microphone. All of these things are assembled from parts, and once all the parts are fitted together appropriately, then we get a function that is useful. Okay? So what we have is a scientific method or capability, a methodology that gives us a capability to observe certain facts about the physical world from which we can often properly infer something about a non-physical element, okay? In the physical world, you simply have event causation. You have one event causing another event, causing another event, causing another event. And whenever you have an event, it is always appropriate to ask which event came before it to cause it. But that itself is an event that is caused by some prior event. So you can see right away, if all you have is event causation, you're going to have an infinite regress that is vicious. All right, that's not going to work. But we are aware of a different type of cause, and that is agent causation, because we are agents ourselves. And agents can initiate a series of events. So think of all the dominoes standing up. Let's just say they were standing there forever, and no physical thing is ever going to move them. Except an agent can use a physical body that the agent controls and flick the first domino and all the rest of them start falling. The agent initiates a series of events. We're aware of that. And so when we look at events that need an initiator outside of the physical universe, like the Big Bang, for example, or the whatever one construes as the origin of the universe, it makes sense, based on our understanding of agency and causation and a sufficient reason, these are all factors here that are not, they are not empirically determined, but they are essential for the scientific method to work at all. We can then say the whole world came into being and there must be a sufficient reason for that. There must be a cause. But the cause has to be adequate to the effect. And so in this way, and this is the classic cosmological arguments, whether it's the Kalam argument or the Leibnizian argument from sufficient reason, which doesn't require a beginning of the universe, not that one, we can still infer from the reality of the universe a cause beyond the universe, a non-physical cause. So I'm being very careful how I'm answering this question, and I'm confining the scientific method to an empirical method, but I am saying we have more tools of knowledge than empiricism, that in fact even science must use metaphysical principles like causation and sufficient reason, etc., in order for science to work. Well, if we have those tools, then we can take things that science discovers about the physical realm and properly infer, at least in principle, certain things about the non-physical or, if you will, supernatural realm as well.
Mm-hmm. So we can use rational thinking about what we find in science, but not necessarily do experiments, since experimentation can only measure repeatable things. Obviously, that can't prove an agent in terms of showing that by doing an experiment that an agent did something. We don't use that to discover anything in history, which mm-hmm. is all agent causation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do experiments. So anyway, I agree, Greg, that what we can learn is anywhere that the worldview touches on the physical world and there are implications that match the worldview. Does that?
Mm-hmm. By the way, you mentioned experimental repeatability, which is one of the most common features people think of regarding the scientific method. This is not a necessary part of the scientific method. There's all different areas of science where experimental repeatability is not a factor, like singularities. Those are like the Big Bang. I mean, there's no question that is a proper feature of the scientific pursuit, origin of the universe. A lot of that is simply math.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of it, like general relativity and special relativity. The math there, from the math, you properly infer an absolute beginning. There is some observation involved there, maybe a redshift, observations, the galaxies, et cetera, from which you infer an expanding universe and then logically infer a beginning. Or you look at the second law of thermodynamics and you realize that there's an entropy, but we're not at maximum entropy now, so the universe can't be eternal, and so therefore the universe must have had a beginning. And these are all things that can be used that are not functions of experimental repeatability. The fact is that the scientific method isn't one thing. It's a constellation of different things that apply at different times. But I think realistically or arguably, the the element that is consistent throughout is that there is some use of empirical means along with rational means in order to discover things that are true about the physical universe, but can also be used, as I've said, to infer things about the non-physical universe.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that we know physically. We can test in a certain sense physically, from which we can properly infer the existence of a soul. And this, for example, is remote viewing. When a person seems to be totally expired, yet when they come back, they're able to describe things that happened down the hall or in a different city that they went to while their body was inert and describe them accurately. That's called remote viewing. And there's thousands of examples of this. That's evidential to demonstrate that there is a, we have physical reasons, physically evidential reasons, dead body, but an individual then coming back to life who's reporting these things, for which the only legitimate explanation is a rational soul, the existence of a rational soul. So these things dovetailed in some way, and we want to be careful about that, but we can't, I think, arbitrarily dismiss these conclusions that follow from reflection on facts we learn from scientific methodology. That would be the imposition of an artificial worldview called materialism. So we want to follow the facts where they lead, and not the way I put it when I talk about this. Do we want the right answers, or do we want the right kind of answers? And ultimately, when it comes to science, when push comes to shove, they want the right kind of answers,
mm-hmm.
and that's the imposition of metaphysical naturalism.
Let's go on to a question from Drew. How would you respond to this statement that was made in response to Mr. B's "Is the Bible a Pro-Life Book?" video? And here's the statement. The Bible cannot be used against abortion. There is the commandment to execute adulterous women without any provision to check if they are pregnant.
Well, I've actually never heard that one before, and it's interesting. Since I haven't heard this, I have to think through it just a little bit. For one, we have to be careful of arguments from silence, all right? Because there is no commandment or provision in there doesn't mean that this wasn't taken into consideration. It's just not part of the formal law, and possibly because it was not considered a factor. And by the way, how do you tell a woman is pregnant anyway? We can do that now through medical means. Back then, there's physical manifestations of pregnancy, but but they don't manifest themselves until after gestation. Or after fertilization. So there may be ambiguity there. How do you know that? Okay. But it may have been the case. In fact, even in modern law, if a woman is scheduled to be executed and she's pregnant, the execution is delayed until she delivers. All right. So I have no reason to believe that that wasn't the case. But here's the other factor is you can't simply grab one verse and infer from that verse something that may not be true and then make a blanket statement that the Bible is not pro-life. Do we have any other passages or sections of Scripture or parts that is meant to indicate that the unborn is as fully human in God's eyes as a born person? And the answer is yes, we do. And I have argued from Luke chapter 1, and I'm not sure, Tim, I think in one of his Red Pen Logics, Mr. B has made this point too, that there you have John the Baptist sleeping with joy in the womb of his mother. He's not called John the Baptist there. He's not even called John yet, but he is himself. In other words, that is John the Baptist rigidly designated, regardless of what they call him at that point. It is the child that leaps with joy in his womb in the presence of Jesus, the Messiah, and John the Baptist at that point is a second trimester fetus, and Jesus is a zygote. Yet they are still, we can infer from the passage, they are still themselves, as it were, and their noble selves, indeed, even though they're in the womb. There's another thing. I actually did an article on this, Exodus 21:22, and I did an interview a couple weeks on this. And there's a passage there in some translations say if there's a struggle and there is a miscarriage, a struggle where a woman is involved who's pregnant and there's a miscarriage, that that there's a fine that's levied. But if the woman dies, then life for life. Okay, so it appears, at least in some translations on first blush, that the unborn is not treated in the same way as a born person, all right, in the law. But when you look more closely at the passage, you realize it doesn't say miscarriage in the original. There is a Hebrew word for that, but that isn't the word that's used. Instead, it just simply says the child comes out. Now, the child, so it's a premature birth. And then it says, so for a premature birth, there's a fine. But if there is any further damage or further injury, then the fine should be life for life. Okay? And so here's a passage, when properly translated and understood in its context, does make the point that the unborn is a valuable human being on par with the mother of the child yet to be born. Okay, so what I'm saying is we have some very, very clear passages that give decisive, from which we can draw a decisive conclusion that the Bible is pro-life in the sense that we normally use the word. And so those arguments cannot be successfully inveighed against by making this reference to capital punishment of a woman when there's no apparent test for pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. There is a special horror in the Old Testament for the killing of children. And I don't see why that wouldn't apply to the youngest, you know, the ones in the womb as well. But in addition to everything you said, but also you have to keep in mind here, too, that if the woman is stoned for adultery, there's nothing there to whatsoever to do with abortion. It's a punishment for adultery. If a child dies because of that, that is a result of her sin. Like in the Old Testament, you see that a lot. Think about David's son who died because of his sin. There's a resulting
consequence.
The punishment for sin. Yes, the consequence can move on to the next generation, move on to other people, because of the parents. But the goal of the punishment is not to kill the child.
Right.
The goal of the punishment is to punish adultery.
Mm-hmm.
So to say that this punishment is about abortion or that it makes it not pro-life is just to misunderstand what it's about.
Right. Good response, Amy.
We've talked about other areas of the Old Testament because this comes up a lot. But like you said, Greg, you have to look at the clear examples of where they're discussing the unborn children and the view of children and the view of human beings and the view of killing the innocent overall to make sense of this. And you can't just pick out one verse and then try to find some loophole.
That's exactly what it is. I remember Tim Barnett making a clever observation. He says, some people ask questions because they're looking for answers. Other people ask questions because they're looking for exits or something like that. And that would be kind of the loophole thing. You know, yeah. This, I think, is one of those examples.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you, Richard and Drew, for your questions. We always appreciate that. Send us your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk, or you can go through our website. Just find our contact page, and you'll have the option to choose what question you're asking. And so choose I have another question and put hashtag STRAsk somewhere in your question. Just keep in mind, you need to keep it to just maybe two sentences It's only 280 characters for a tweet, so try to keep it under that, and then we'll consider your question. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Thanks for listening.